Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident going into radiology. This will be the 72nd episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. I'm going to say that this is going to be a podcast that's related to endocrinology and endocrine pharmacology. And this, again, will likely be a two-part episode because I'm actually going to spend some time in the very beginning to talk about some physiology, which will make the pharmacology a lot easier to understand. And basically, in today's podcast, I'm going to cover calcium pharmacology and physiology. I'm going to cover thyroid pharmacology and physiology. And then I'll start on the drugs that I use to treat diabetes. I would go all the way to metformin. The other drugs, I'll cover them in the next podcast. And then also the adrenal drugs and whatnot. So let's begin. So let's talk about calcium physiology to start with. So the thing is, remember that PTH, right, is like the big hormone that controls your blood calcium levels, especially it brings up your blood calcium levels, right? So where does PTH come from? PTH comes from the parathyroid gland, right? And remember, the parathyroid gland actually has a calcium sensing receptor. Okay, has a calcium sensing receptor. If it senses low levels of calcium in the serum, you'll secrete more PTH. If it senses high levels of calcium in the serum, you'll secrete less PTH. Now, PTH does a ton of stuff, right? I said that in general, PTH's job is to increase your blood calcium levels and to decrease your blood phosphate levels, right? So that's why PTH is occasionally known as the phosphate trashing hormone. So how does PTH go about accomplishing these objectives? The thing is, PTH, right, it increases calcium reabsorption in the nephron. That's one thing it does. Another thing PTH does is that it activates, and actually, if you're thinking about PTH increasing calcium reabsorption in the nephron, it's actually very high yield to know that PTH does this by activating a calcium channel that is found at the distal convoluted tubule, okay? In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I believe I talked about that transporter in the context of how thiazides can cause hypercalcemia. I believe I described that potential like mechanism behind that in my renal review. That's like some episodes back. And then PTH, right, it trashes phosphate. And the way PTH has the ability to trash phosphate is by inhibiting that sodium phosphate symporter that you find at the proximal convoluted tubule. That symporter uses the sodium gradient. So sodium is going from a high concentration outside the cell to inside the cell, and then it uses secondary active transport to bring phosphate in. That sodium phosphate symporter at the proximal convoluted tubule is inhibited by PTH. Okay, so that's the mechanism behind PTH helping you trash phosphate. Another thing PTH does is that it activates 1-alpha hydroxylase. Okay, 1-alpha hydroxylase, you find it in the kidneys, and the job of 1-alpha hydroxylase is to take 25 hydroxy vitamin D, also known as calcidiol, that's made in the liver, and converts it to 125 dihydroxy vitamin D. That's what's known as calcitriol. Calcitriol is the active form of vitamin D. And then calcitriol increases the reabsorption of calcium and phosphate in the gut, right? And the thing is, PTH, you may say, oh, Divine, how does PTH raise your blood calcium levels? I already talked about how it increases reabsorption at the level of the kidneys, right, at the distal convoluted tubule. I also talked about how it activates vitamin D so that you increase calcium and phosphate reabsorption in the gut. But one other thing vitamin D does, I mean, one other thing PTH does is that it directly activates your osteoclasts so that you can resorb bone and again also raise your blood calcium levels. But how does PTH go about this job, right? Basically, the way PTH does this is that it actually activates osteoblasts, and then those osteoblasts proceed to activate osteoclasts. So how does that process work? The way that process works is that you activate the osteoblasts with PTH. And then when those osteoblasts are activated, they release a ton of, they release something known as RANK ligand. Okay, RANK ligand. That RANK ligand has the ability to bind to a receptor found on the surface of osteoclasts, known as the RANK receptor. When RANK ligand binds to that RANK receptor, that activates osteoclasts to go ahead and resorb bone. So think about it. If you're a person that has osteoporosis, you probably don't want RANK ligand to ever see the RANK receptor that you find on osteoclasts, so that you don't resorb your bone more and get into even more trouble. So the way that your body prevents that, I mean, the way you can pharmacologically prevent that is with a drug known as a denosumab. Denosumab is a drug I'll talk about shortly. I guess I'm talking about it now. But it's a RANK ligand, it's a monoclonal antibody against the RANK ligand. So it binds up the RANK ligand so that you never have the ability to have RANK ligand interacting with the RANK receptor. And then another physiology tie in here, right? So you may notice that women have a very low risk of osteoporosis before the age of 50, but they have a very high risk of osteoporosis after the age of 50. The thing is, in women, right, prior to the age of 50, you're producing a ton of estrogen from your ovaries. Well, that estrogen increases the synthesis of a protein known as osteoprotegrin, okay? Osteoprotegrin is a protein that whose synthesis is increased by estrogen. So if you're premenopausal, you have a ton of estrogen, you have a ton of osteoprotegrin. It so happens that osteoprotegrin actually binds up RANK ligand. So that prevents the interaction between RANK ligand and the RANK receptor. And if you don't have that interaction, you will not have bone resorption. So that's potentially the mechanism behind premenopausal women having a lower risk of osteoporosis, right? And obviously, if you're an obese postmenopausal female, you also have a low risk of osteoporosis, okay? Very likely by this mechanism as well. So actually being obese, right, because you are more weight bearing, it actually decreases your risk of osteoporosis. But being obese actually increases your risk of osteoarthritis, okay? Just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And classically on the USMLEs, they can give you a question about an anorexic patient. Patients with anorexia nervosa, they actually have an increased risk of like early onset osteoporosis. Just one of those weird things that they test on the exams that you want to keep at the back of your mind. So let's talk about a few diseases, right? And like your calcium balance in those diseases, right? So let's assume a person has liver disease, right? So think about this. If a person has liver disease, they are not making 25 hydroxy vitamin D. They're not making calcidiol, right? So they basically have no feedstock for the production of calcitriol. And if you don't make calcitriol, then you will not reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut. So you'll be hypocalcemic. So your blood calcium levels will be low. If your blood calcium is low, right, that should raise your PTH. Well, if your PTH goes up, then what do you think will happen to your phosphate levels? Your phosphate levels will actually go down, okay? Because your kidneys are working just fine, right? So as your PTH levels go up, you'll have hypophosphatemia because you're appropriately trashing the phosphate because your PTH is high. Contrast that with a person that has kidney disease, right? So if a person has kidney disease, your liver is working just fine, right? So that liver makes that liver makes calcidiol, right? So like the 25 hydroxy vitamin D, but there is no 1-alpha hydroxylase to work on that calcidiol to make it into active vitamin D, which is known as calcitriol. So because you're not making active vitamin D, your calcium and phosphate will not be reabsorbed in the gut, so you'll have hypocalcemia. So your blood calcium levels will be low in kidney disease. And if your blood calcium levels are low, guess what will happen to your PTH? It will go high, right? So your PTH will go up. But this is where you need to be careful. Yes, PTH is known as the phosphate trashing hormone. So yes, if your PTH is high, your phosphate should be low, right? But the thing is, if you have kidney disease, your kidney is the organ that helps you trash phosphate. So if you have kidney disease, even if your PTH level is high, your phosphate level will actually be high as well, right? Because you cannot appropriately trash that phosphate. So kidney disease and liver disease are both causes of secondary hyperparathyroidism, okay? They are both causes of secondary hyperparathyroidism. But the way you differentiate between kidney disease as the cause of secondary hyperparathyroidism and liver disease as a cause of secondary hyperparathyroidism is to look at the levels of phosphate, because your calcium is low in both, your PTH is high in both, but your phosphate will be high in kidney disease as a cause of secondary hyperparathyroidism because you cannot appropriately trash the phosphate. But in liver disease, your phosphate will be low because your kidneys are working, so you will appropriately trash the phosphate when your PTH is high. Make sure that makes sense to you. It's a very high yield concept to know for basically your medical future. I mean, these are things that come up on exams fairly frequently. And then another disease I'll talk about is like if a person has like squamous cell cancer, right, of the lung. In fact, not just for the lung, but most squamous cell cancers produce something known as PTHRP, right? So parathyroid hormone related peptide. So the thing that PTHRP does is it basically acts like PTH, right? So the thing is, in squamous cell cancer of the lung, right, where a person is making PTH related peptide, what do you think will be true of their blood calcium levels? Well, I'm hoping you're saying it will be high, right? Because again, PTHRP will do what PTH does. So your blood calcium levels will be high. And if your blood calcium levels are high, what will be true of your blood PTH? Your PTH will go down. Remember, PTH is not the same thing as PTHRP. So PTH levels are actually low in patients that have squamous cell lung cancer, producing PTHRP in a paraneoplastic phenomenon. Okay? And because those people have low PTH, right, what will be true of their phosphate? What do you think? Their phosphate will actually be high. Exactly. Their phosphate will be high. Okay? Their phosphate will be high. So it's just one of those weird things that you need to keep at the... Their phosphate will be low. Whoops. Their phosphate will be low. Because PTHRP works like PTH, right? So you will trash phosphate because your kidneys are working fine. So your blood phosphate levels will be low. Now, let's assume a person has a disease known as familial. You should never get this wrong on an exam because literally the answer is in the term. Assume a person has this disease known as familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, right? What do you think will be true of their blood calcium levels? It will actually be high, okay? But because they have, I mean, the pathophysiology of FHH basically involves like a sensing defect in the calcium sensing receptor, right? So your calcium sensing receptor, even if you have like high blood calcium levels, it doesn't understand that you should decrease the release of PTH. So your PTH levels are actually high. So your PTH will be high in FHH and your blood calcium levels will be high as well. Okay. And again, because PTH is a phosphate trashing hormone, your blood phosphate will be low. So what if a person has primary hyperparathyroidism, right? So primary hyperparathyroidism, right, arises because you have a parathyroid adenoma, right? You basically have this adenoma that's autonomously secreting a ton of PTH. Well, if that is the case, your PTH will be high. So because your PTH is high, your calcium will be high, right? Your blood calcium will be high. If your blood calcium is high, right, because you also, again, have high PTH, your phosphate will be low. Okay, so let's think about this for a second. So you may say, Divine, how do I tell, think about this for a second. In primary hyperparathyroidism, your PTH is high, your blood calcium is high, your blood phosphate is low. Well, guess what? In familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, your PTH is also high because your calcium sensing receptor is not working. Your blood calcium is also high. Your blood phosphate is also low. So you may say, Divine, how do I differentiate between these two? That's where you need to look at the urinary calcium, okay? If a person has primary hyperparathyroidism, okay? If a person has primary hyperparathyroidism, because they have a ton of calcium in their blood, they'll have a ton of calcium in the urine, okay? And because, again, their calcium sensing receptors are working just fine, right? They'll be like, this is a lot of calcium. Let's get rid of some of it in the urine, right? So those people actually have high urinary calcium. Contrast that with people that have FHH who cannot appropriately sense that they have hypercalcemia on board. In the kidneys, your normal response to hypercalcemia is to waste more calcium in the urine. But if your calcium sensing receptor is not working, then that normal response does not kick into gear. So actually, instead of wasting calcium in the urine, you reabsorb more as much calcium as possible from the urine in FHH. So those people actually have low urinary calcium. Again, that's super, super high yield to know for exams. So let's just sort of summarize all of this. If a person has primary hyperparathyroidism, their PTH will be high, their blood calcium will be high, their blood phosphate will be low, their urinary calcium will be high. If a person has FHH, so familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, their PTH will be high because their calcium sensing receptor doesn't know when to slow down on encouraging the release of PTH. So their PTH is high. Because their PTH is high, their calcium is high. Because their PTH is high, their phosphate is low. But because their calcium sensing receptor doesn't work right, they actually increase the reabsorption of calcium in the urine. So they have low urinary calcium. If a person has squamous cell lung cancer that is secreting PTHRP in a paraneoplastic fashion, those people's PTHRP will be high. And because their PTHRP will be high, you'll get a PTH-like response. The blood calcium will be high, the blood phosphate will be low. Okay? And actually, because your blood calcium is high, right? And because your kidneys are working fine, your calcium sensing receptor is working fine, your urinary calcium will also be high, okay? In PTHRP paraneoplastic business with squamous cell lung cancer. But these people that have squamous cell lung cancer, they will actually have low PTH, okay? Because that hypercalcemia will appropriately suppress the release of PTH from those people's native parathyroid glands, okay? PTHRP will be high, but PTH itself will be low in those people. And then in secondary hyperparathyroidism that arises from kidney disease, because you don't have 1-alpha hydroxylase working, you're not making active vitamin D, so you'll be hypocalcemic. So your blood calcium will be low. Because your blood calcium is low, your PTH will be high. Yes, your PTH is high, but your phosphate will actually be high because your kidneys are not working, so you do not appropriately trash the phosphate. Contrast that with liver disease as a cause of secondary hyperparathyroidism. If you have liver disease, you're not making calcidiol. So if you're not making calcidiol, there's no feedstock for calcitriol. So there's no feedstock for active vitamin D. So you will not reabsorb calcium and phosphate in the gut. So your blood calcium will be low. If your blood calcium is low, your PTH will be high. Because your kidneys are working right, you will appropriately trash phosphate. So your phosphate will be low. Okay? Very high yield to know that. And I guess we can also talk about tertiary hyperparathyroidism. I know you may say, Divine, where is the pharmacology here? I promise you, like, if you understand all this, like, all the stuff I'm saying is super, super high yield. I will very likely have, like, a dedicated endocrine review podcast, but I just thought I should just go ahead and talk about these here, because these things are just things that confuse people a lot, and the repetition always helps. So, let's talk about tertiary hyperparathyroidism, right? So the classic scenario for tertiary hyperparathyroidism on MBMEs is that they'll talk about a patient that has had like chronic kidney disease, right? I told you that chronic kidney disease causes secondary hyperparathyroidism, right? But let's assume those people then get a kidney transplant, right? If you get a kidney transplant, 1-alpha hydroxylase is back on board, right? So your calcium physiology should work right. So if your kidney comes back on board, you're making active vitamin D, you're like, oh, okay, so my calcium should be fine, my PTH should return back to normal levels and all that stuff. But that may not be the case. So think about it, right? So it's just sort of think of like a habit you have. If you've done something consistently for like decades and decades and decades and decades, right? It's hard for a person to just suddenly just stop doing that thing, right? So I sort of think of that in the context of the parathyroid glands. If a person has had chronic kidney disease for years and your parathyroid glands are used to making a ton of PTH, right? Even if your kidneys come back online, right? The transplanted kidneys, at least in this case, your parathyroid glands are no longer responsive to normal signals. So in tertiary hyperparathyroidism, your PTH is high. Okay, if your PTH is high, guess what? Your calcium will be high. If your calcium is high, guess what? Your phosphate will be low. Because now you have good kidneys, so you can appropriately trash the phosphate. And then, if your phosphate is low, what do you think your urinary calcium will also be in tertiary hyperparathyroidism? Your urinary calcium will be high. So basically, tertiary hyperparathyroidism has the same lab values as primary hyperparathyroidism. Okay, Although, the treatment, and the thing is, usually, if you read the question carefully, the history will be able to tell you that, oh, this is what I'm dealing with, right? And the thing is, in terms of primary hyperparathyroidism, usually the way you treat that is to remove the parathyroid adenoma, right? And the problem is solved for those people. However, if a person has tertiary hyperparathyroidism, you actually do not remove the parathyroid I'll say in general, people that have tertiary hyperparathyroidism don't necessarily have a parathyroid adenoma as the cause of that tertiary hyperparathyroidism. So instead of removing like some adenoma, no, that's not what you do for tertiary hyperparathyroidism. In tertiary hyperparathyroidism, you actually remove 3.5 parathyroid glands. I know you're like, Divine, 3.5? Yes, you heard me right. You remove 3.5 parathyroid glands because usually you have hyperplasia of the entire parathyroid gland, like the 4 parathyroid glands in the setting of tertiary hyperparathyroidism and also in chronic kidney disease. Now that I mentioned that, one other good idea that came to my mind is, this is again, tricky, common tricky exam situation that you see on the USMLEs, right? So, if a person has primary hyperparathyroidism, usually, it arises in the setting of a parathyroid adenoma, okay? So, this is actually very high yield to know. The most common cause, the most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism is a parathyroid adenoma. However, in patients that have MEN1 syndrome, okay, in patients that have, in fact, any of the MEN syndromes that present with primary hyperparathyroidism, the most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism in patients with MEN syndrome is parathyroid hyperplasia, okay, not parathyroid adenoma. Parathyroid adenoma occurs with primary hyperparathyroidism in the general population, okay, but parathyroid hyperplasia is the most common cause of primary hyperparathyroidism in patients with MEN syndromes. And then the last thing I will say before I sort of begin to delve into the pharmacology is that in tertiary hyperparathyroidism, I said you can remove 3.5 parathyroid glands. One other thing you can do is you can try to modulate the activity of the calcium sensing receptor. And the way you can do that is with a drug known as cinacalcet. Cinacalcet is a calcium sensing receptor modulator that can actually help in the treatment of tertiary hyperparathyroidism. It basically sort of tells the calcium sensing receptor that calcium is a little too high. Let's dumb down on the release of PTH. Okay, so let's move on then. One more thing. Sorry, all these high yield ideas are coming to my mind now. So, if a person in the hospital has hypercalcemia, the most common cause is malignancy, okay? Just one of those things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, so back to the real world. Although it could, think about hypercalcemia or malignancy, but I feel like many people have seen in the hospital, at least being an intern, with hypercalcemia was from chronic kidney disease. No. You know what? Just scratch that. Just forget that I said that. Think about malignancy. I think I was thinking in the wrong direction there. Okay. So back to this. So just again, a few key conditions like osteoporosis. Remember, your calcium balance will be normal. If a person has like Paget's disease of the bone, right, your calcium will be normal. Right? If basically all your calcium labs are normal with the exception of ALK-FOS will be elevated. And then I already talked about MEN1, right? Remember parapanpit. In MEN1, those people have pituitary adenomas, right? So most commonly it's a prolactinoma. They will also have parathyroid hyperplasia, okay? Not adenoma, parathyroid hyperplasia. And then they can have like pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So they can have like gastrinomas that present as the Zollinger-Lissen syndrome. For that, you want to give a PPI, right? Or they can have vipomas. Remember, vipomas present as the WDHA syndrome, where people have like watery diarrhea, hypokalemia, and achlorhydria. For that, you want to go ahead and give octreotide. They can have insulinomas. Remember, insulinomas are associated with Whipple's triad, right, of like hypoglycemia, symptoms of hypoglycemia, and then relief of those symptoms with the administration of glucose, okay? For insulinomas, you want to give diazoxide. Remember, diazoxide is a potassium channel opener, right? Because if you remember, right, the way you secrete insulin in the first place is that glucose will come into a pancreatic beta islet cell, As that glucose comes in, it's converted to glucose 6-phosphate by, hopefully you're not saying hexokinase, but you're saying glucokinase. And then that glucose 6-phosphate helps you make ATP. And then that ATP goes and closes up an ATP-dependent potassium channel. And then that cell depolarizes. And then when the cell depolarizes, you squirt out insulin. Okay? So if you open up that potassium channel with diazoxide, then the cell will not depolarize. If the cell does not depolarize, then guess what? You will not release insulin, okay? So diazoxide can actually be used to treat insulinomas. But if you remember from the podcast from yesterday, right? So episode 71, where I talked about oncopharmacology, I said that there is a nitrosourea known as streptozocin. Streptozocin is an alkylating, basically it's an alkylating agent, right? It's also used for the treatment of insulinomas. It is very toxic as a drug to the pancreatic beta islet cell. So it can also be used in the treatment of insulinomas. And then another pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor that may be observed in MEN1 is a glucagonoma, right? So basically, they'll give you a person that has like relentless diabetes and skin rash, right? The boss phrase for that skin rash is a necrolytic migratory erythema, okay? And then in MEN2A, those people have pheochromocytomas. Remember, pheos, they present with like the episodic headache and hypertension, usually in a younger person. And remember that pheochromocytomas, right, they don't show up in the anterior mediastinum. They show up in the posterior mediastinum because they are a neuro-based tumor, right? And remember that pheos will be derived from neurocrest cells. Those are very nice embryology details that could be tested on step one. And then remember that in MEN2A, those people can also get medullary thyroid cancer, right? And remember the tumor marker for medullary thyroid cancer is calcitonin, right? And calcitonin, what does calcitonin do to your blood calcium levels? Well, remember that calcitones down your blood calcium levels, okay? So hypocalcemia may actually be a presentation of MEN2A, okay? And then in MEN2A, you can also observe a parathyroid hyperplasia. In fact, I'll tell you this, patients that have MEN2A or 2B, they need to get a prophylactic thyroidectomy, because their chances of getting a medullary thyroid cancer is like 100%. Like, it's not a matter of if they will get medullary thyroid cancer, it's just a matter of when, okay? So those patients, almost always, you should recommend a total thyroidectomy for those people. And then MEN2B, right? Those people, again, still have the pheochromocytomas, they still have the medullary thyroid cancers, they also have like mucosal neuromas, right? And also like a Marfanoid body habitus, right? Don't forget that other things that can cause a Marfanoid body habitus include diseases like homocystinuria. Usually that's like a Marfanoid body habitus with intellectual disability, and then Marfan syndrome, where they have a Marfanoid body habitus but without intellectual disability, right? Just one of those weird things you want to keep in mind for your exam. Okay. And hypocalcemia, right? Again, hypocalcemia, so again, now I'm actually studying pharmacology. So hypocalcemia, right, classically arises from chronic kidney, it can arise from like chronic kidney disease. I already explained the mechanism. If a person has hypocalcemia from chronic kidney disease, right, you want to go ahead and give give them calcium supplementation, give them calcitriol, right? So calcitriol is 125 dihydroxyvitamin D, right? That'll fix their problem, okay? Hypocalcemia, right? Again, like I said, if a person has like medullary thyroid cancer that's secreted a ton of calcitonin, those people could also have a hypocalcemia, right? Because calcitones down your blood calcium levels. Now, if a person has hypercalcemia, right, how do you treat hypercalcemia? You can give calcitonin certainly helps. Another thing you can do is you can actually give furosemide, right? Remember, loops lose calcium, right? Because they block that sodium potassium 2 chloride transporter at the level of the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle, right? So if you block that transporter, right, you will not reabsorb those positive ions. And when you don't reabsorb those positive ions, you will not extrude potassium that will then help you paracellularly reabsorb calcium and magnesium, okay? So you actually lose a lot of calcium in your urine if you're on a loop diuretic like furosemide, okay? So furosemide can actually help quite a bit in a hypercalcemia. And then bisphosphonates, right, can be used for the treatment of hypercalcemia. The thing is, bisphosphonates, they cause apoptosis of osteoclasts, right? So you don't break down your bone anymore. And the thing is, you can actually use bisphosphonates to treat like Paget's disease, right? So Paget's disease, classic exam presentation will be like an old person that has like heart's not feeling well, and they have like cranial nerve deficits, like they have like decreased hearing, and all that stuff. For those people, think about giving them bisphosphonates. Bisphosphonates are the drug of choice for the treatment of Paget's disease. And also, please don't forget that you can, in Paget's disease, those people can have something known as a high output heart failure, right? Because those people's bones become hypervascular. So that causes like a functional decrease in systemic vascular resistance. So that can ultimately cause a high output heart failure. Some of those, again, bizarre things you want to keep in mind for your exam. Now, if a person has like hypercalcemia of malignancy, right? So from like PTHRP, paraneoplastic phenomenon, or from multiple myeloma, for example. For those people, the way you treat that hypercalcemia of malignancy is actually to go ahead and give bisphosphonates. Although I will say that in multiple myeloma, that hypercalcemia that they get is not necessarily from PTHRP. It's actually more from interleukin-1 that's made by those plasma cells, right? So that interleukin-1 causes, it's also known as... I believe another name for interleukin-1 is osteoclast activating factor. So when you activate those osteoclasts, that will cause you to resorb bone, and that will increase your blood calcium levels. Actually, in a person that has multiple myeloma, that has hypercalcemia, yeah, you can give them bisphosphonates, but actually steroids work extremely well in that population as well. Just one of those, like, I don't see that ever showing up on a USMLE, but if you did, you'll get it right because you listen to this podcast. And then if a person also has osteoporosis, right? Osteoporosis, you can also treat with a bisphosphonate, right? Remember, the cutoff T-score for osteoporosis is a T-score of negative 2.5 or less, right? If people have those like low T-scores, you need to place them on a bisphosphonate. And just, I guess a high yield thing I'll go ahead and say here is that, again, I know you may say, Divine, you're not really dipping your hand in much pharmacology here. You're just talking about all these other scenarios. Yes, I know. But the thing is, they don't always just test like direct pharmacology on the USMLEs, right? They try to, integrate concepts together, right? So I think that's probably the best way to actually learn this stuff, right? So what's another way they can test bisphosphonates before I talk about the side effects of bisphosphonates? The thing is, if a person is on chronic steroids for like an autoimmune disorder or some kind of rheumatologic disorder, for those people, if a person has to be on chronic steroids, or let's say they have like end-stage COPD or really bad asthma where they have to take like daily oral steroids, you need to place those people on two kinds of drugs. One, you need to place them on bisphosphonates, because remember, steroids actually increase your risk of osteoporosis. And then you also have to place those people on PPIs, right? If a person is taking chronic steroids, you need to place them on PPIs because steroids increase a person's risk of peptic ulcer disease. Okay, now, what are the side effects of bisphosphonates? There are two you need to know. One is that bisphosphonates can cause something called an erosive esophagitis, okay? And they can also cause like osteonecrosis of the jaw, okay? If you're thinking more about... like hip osteonecrosis, think more about steroids causing that. Steroids tend to cause like osteonecrosis of the hip, or you can say like avascular necrosis, whatever. But bisphosphonates tend to cause more of an osteonecrosis of the jaw. I don't really know why, how that happens. And then I already talked about denosumab, right? Again, you can use it to treat hypercalcemia. It binds up RANK ligand, has a similar mechanism of action to osteoprotegrin. I already described that. And then if a person has like, again, really bad osteoporosis, I said first line is a bisphosphonate, right? But another thing you can actually use to treat osteoporosis is a drug known as teriparatide, okay? Teriparatide is a PTH analog, right? So this is a concept you should maybe try to sort of, you know, like link in your mind. Whenever you give something in a pulsatile fashion, it upregulates a pathway. But if you give something in a continuous fashion, it shuts down that pathway. For example, if you give a person pulsatile GnRH, that will upregulate the activity of the HPG axis. If you give a person continuous GnRH, that will downregulate the activity of the HPG axis. Same thing obtains with PTH. When you give PTH in a pulsatile fashion, that actually causes a buildup of bone. If you give PTH in a continuous fashion, that actually causes resorption of bone. So this is where teriparatide comes into play. When you give teriparatide, which is a PTH analog, in a pulsatile fashion over like like a year or thereabouts, that can actually really increase your bone density, okay? And that can be used as treatment for osteoporosis, okay? In fact, it can almost like reverse the osteoporosis a person has. Now, the thing is, you need to be careful though. You cannot give like, I mean, you're like, oh man, Divine, this sounds like a great drug. No, you cannot give teriparatide forever, right? Because think about it, you're essentially giving a growth factor, a stimulating factor for bone. So guess what? Teriparatide, if given for a long enough period, can cause osteosarcoma, okay? So you need to be careful with that. You just give it, I think like the maximum time frame you can give teriparatide for is like 2 years or something like that, so that the person does not get a osteosarcoma, which is clearly not a good thing. What are other things that can cause osteosarcoma, right? So like Paget's disease, right? I say Paget's disease can cause high output heart failure. It can also cause osteosarcoma. Teriparatide, as I just mentioned, can cause osteosarcoma. And then if a person has like an RB gene mutation, right, like a retinoblastoma gene mutation, remember it's a tumor suppressor gene. If a person has that gene mutation, they can also get a osteosarcoma. In fact, the classic way they test that on the USMLEs is they'll describe a kid, a newborn, that has like a white reflex instead of a red reflex, and then you're thinking about retinoblastoma, and then they'll ask that this patient is at increased risk of which of the following malignancies in the future, and that'll be an osteosarcoma. Okay, just again, one of those higher things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, I guess I should also mention this disease, osteopetrosis. Osteopetrosis, right? It arises from a carbonic anhydrase 2 mutation, right? Remember, carbonic anhydrase 2, your osteoclasts, they use that enzyme a lot to basically make like acid that can resorb bone. That's how osteoclasts resorb bone. So if you have a mutation in that enzyme, your osteoclasts don't work right, so they don't have the ability to resorb bone. And if you cannot resorb bone, that's clearly not a good thing, right? Your bone will just be not right, basically. In fact, osteopetrosis is known as a brittle bone disease. It's one of those bizarre things you want to, again, keep at the back of your mind. Osteopetrosis is actually treated with bisphosphonates. That's why I'm talking about it here. Now, that's really all I'll say about calcium pharmacology and physiology, I guess. So now I'm going to talk about thyroid pharmacology, okay? But before we can talk about thyroid pharmacology, we have to talk about thyroid physiology first, okay? But this will be a much shorter discussion, well, hopefully, than calcium physiology. So, how do we make thyroid hormone, right? The thing is, iodide, right? Again, this thing all starts with the sodium-potassium ATPase pump, right? The sodium-potassium ATPase pump pumps 3 sodiums out of the cell and brings 2 potassiums into the cell, right? So, sodium is primarily an extracellular ion for that purpose. So because sodium is really high outside the cell, we can use its gradient energy to bring that sodium into the cell. And as it's flowing down its gradient into the cell, we can use secondary active transport to bring other stuff into the cell, like iodine, for example, right? So iodine comes into the thyroid follicular cell through a sodium iodide symporter, okay? That's an example of secondary active transport. And then when the iodide gets into the cell, right, it becomes oxidized, right? So it goes from like I minus to like elemental iodine, right? It's like I2, right? Remember, if you sort of throw back to general chemistry from college, oxidation occurs when you have a decrease in your, when your oxidation number becomes more positive, right? So if you're going from iodide, that's a -1 charge, to iodine, that's a 0 charge. The oxidation number has become more positive, okay? And that's the oxidation step of thyroid hormone synthesis. And then after that, you have something known as organification. Organification basically happens where you join that iodine to thyroglobulin, okay? You join the iodine to thyroglobulin, okay? And when you do that, you begin to make things like MIT and DIT. I always make fun of my friends that went to MIT for undergrad with this. So like, I guess if you listen to DIT as well, it sort of applies to you. So you form like MITs and DITs, right? And if you join a DIT and a MIT, you would make T3. If you join 2 DITs, you'll make T4, okay? And if you notice, I'm not talking about any enzymes for this. Basically, the enzyme that does all this thyroid hormone synthesis is thyroperoxidase. Okay, that's a very big thing you want to know for exams. And then when you make, the thing is, the more active form of thyroid hormone is T3, not T4, okay? But if you look in a person's serum, you generally find more T4 than T3, okay? The thing is, if you want to go from T4 to T3, you can do it in the thyroid gland, or you can actually do it in the periphery. The one you probably care about for exam purposes is the one in the periphery. If you want to go from T4 to T3, you use something known as a 5' deiodinase, right? So deiodinase, get rid of one iodine, okay? So the 5' deiodinase, there's a peripheral one that helps you convert T4 to T3, and then T3 is the metabolically active form of thyroid hormone. And remember that Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? So Hashimoto's is the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the U.S., okay? It's actually associated with anti-thyroperoxidase antibodies. Now, I want to talk about something that's really important, and it's a protein known as thyroglobulin. The thing is, thyroglobulin, the protein, is released at the same time as thyroid hormone, okay? Just like when you release insulin from the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans, as you're releasing insulin, you're releasing C-peptide at the same time. When you're releasing thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland, you also release thyroglobulin. So think of thyroglobulin as the C-peptide of your thyroid gland. You may say, Divine, why do I care about this? Let me tell you why you should care. Classic USMLE exam question is to describe a person that is let's say they have like Graves' disease, right? Or they have like a hyperthyroid, let's say like they have like a, you're trying to distinguish between a person that, for example, has like Graves' disease or some other cause of a thyrotoxic phase from a person that is factitiously injecting thyroid hormone, right? To like fake symptoms. Say, for example, they have like Munchausen's, right? So the thing is, if thyroid hormone is coming from your thyroid gland, your thyroglobulin levels will be high. If thyroid hormone is not coming from your thyroid gland, your thyroglobulin levels will be low. In fact, I'll say more about this when I do the endocrine review podcast. So, if a person is injecting thyroid hormone, their thyroid hormone levels will be high, obviously, but their thyroglobulin levels will be low. But, so that's kind of a dissonance, right? So that's how you know that they're injecting, right? Like they're snacking on their Synthroid or something. But if a person has like Graves' disease, or they have like the Quervain's thyroiditis, or they have like the thyrotoxic phase of Hashimoto's, right? Their thyroid hormone levels can be high, but their thyroglobulin levels will also be high as well, because that thyroid hormone is actually coming from the thyroid gland. Okay. And then there's some like Ryu scan things you can also think about with those, but I'll talk about that in the endocrine review podcast. Okay, so, but actually one thing I should say here is, please do not confuse thyroglobulin with thyroxine binding globulin. Okay, thyroglobulin is different from thyroxine binding globulin. Thyroxine binding globulin, or TBG, basically like binds up thyroid hormone in the circulation. Okay. And one weird thing they love to test with thyroxine-binding globulin is that if a person is pregnant, right, or they're on OCPs, basically anything that causes a hyperestrogenic state will actually raise your levels of thyroxine-binding globulin, okay? So your TBG levels will go up. But actually for those people, their free thyroid hormone levels will still be normal, okay? In fact, you know, let me make this clear, because this thing just comes up way too much on exams. There are three things you need to think about. If a person is taking OCPs or they're pregnant or whatever, their thyroxine binding globulin levels will be high. Their total because the thing is, right, TBG binds up thyroid hormone. So their total thyroid hormone levels will be high as well, but their free thyroid hormone levels will be normal. Okay? So again, I'll repeat that. If a person is on OCPs or they're pregnant, their TBG levels will be high, their total thyroid hormone levels will be high, their free thyroid hormone levels will be normal. Okay, and again, I'll potentially explain the reasoning behind that in the endocrine review podcast. Okay, so now let's go to the anti-thyroid medications. So the anti-thyroid medications, big one you want to know is PTU, right? PTU, methimazole, they both inhibit thyroperoxidase, right? So you basically stop making thyroid hormone. But in contrast to methimazole, PTU actually also has the ability to inhibit that peripheral 5' deiodinase that I talked about that helps you convert T4 to T3, okay? In fact, if a person has thyroid storm, you want to go ahead and give those people PTU instead of methimazole, because PTU theoretically will help with inhibiting that 5' deiodinase. However, if you get a thyroid storm question on your exam and you read the Q-stem and propranolol has not been given yet, you need to give that propranolol first. Propranolol, again, this is like floridly high yield. Propranolol is the first drug that is always given in the setting of thyroid storm. I'll repeat that again. Propranolol is the first drug that is always given in the setting of thyroid storm. So, and why is this? The thing is, I mean, propranolol obviously will prevent whatever arrhythmias, right, that may happen with the hyperthyroid state. Remember, hyperthyroidism can cause AFib. But propranolol also inhibits that fancy 5' deiodinase, right, that converts T4 to T3. So in thyroid storm, you give propranolol, you give PTU, because PTU can also do that 5' deiodinase inhibition business. And in thyroid storm, you can also give steroids. Steroids inhibit that 5' deiodinase. And you can also give a potassium iodide, because you take advantage of something called the Wolff-Chaikoff effect. The Wolff-Chaikoff effect is where giving an iodine load paradoxically causes hypothyroidism. Okay, so those are the things you can use for thyroid storm. You can use propranolol, number one, you can give PTU, you can give steroids, and you can give potassium iodide. Don't confuse the Wolff-Chaikoff effect, where giving an iodine load causes hypothyroidism, with the Yod-Basedow phenomenon, where giving an iodine load causes hyperthyroidism, right? I mean, that's the mechanism behind amiodarone causing hyper and hypothyroidism. Amiodarone can take advantage of the Wolff-Chaikoff effect to cause hypothyroidism, or it can take advantage of the Yod-Basedow phenomenon to cause hyperthyroidism. Okay. And another interesting, I guess, tidbit with regards to PTU is that PTU is actually safe in the first trimester of pregnancy. You may read in some resources that, oh, PTU is always safe in pregnancy. No, it's not. It's only safe in the first trimester. After the first trimester of pregnancy, you need to switch the patient to methimazole, okay? You want to switch the patient to methimazole because in the first trimester, that's where we're like super, super worried about aplasia cutis, which the risk is actually higher with methimazole. But in the second, third trimester, you're not really worried about that. So in those circumstances, you then switch to methimazole. Methimazole is actually the preferred anti-thyroid medication compared to PTU. But PTU is your best choice in two situations and two situations only on exams. One situation is if a person has thyroid storm. The second situation is if a person is in the first trimester of pregnancy. Okay. And remember that PTU can also cause agranulocytosis. Okay. So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. Methimazole, pretty much the same drug, inhibits thyroperoxidase. It's safe pretty much at every time other than in thyroid storm or in the first trimester, so you can give it in trimesters 2 and 3. It can also cause agranulocytosis, can also cause the aplasia cutis, okay? And then I already talked about how amiodarone is associated with hypo and hyperthyroidism. Lithium is associated primarily with hypothyroidism. It's just one of those things, just again, keep it at the back of your mind. Now, let's talk about diabetes, okay? So I'll probably finish this podcast in the next like between 3 and 5 minutes. So let's talk about how we treat type 1 diabetes, right? In type 1 diabetes, you're not making insulin, right? So all those oral hypoglycemic agents, not going to do squat for you. You need to give those people like legit insulin, okay? Although actually, I take that back. There is one drug known as pramlintide. Pramlintide is actually a treatment for type 1 diabetes. It's actually the only like oral medication that you can give to a type 1 diabetic. No one really knows how it works, but it actually like decreases like the rise in blood glucose that accompanies a meal. Okay, it's basically like an analog of something known as amylin, and yeah, it's used to treat type 1 diabetes. Also used to treat type 2 diabetes as well. And I guess sort of like an unrelated point. The thing is, remember, if you're comparing type 1 and type 2 diabetes is actually the one that's associated with amyloid being found in the pancreatic islets. So if you get a question where they say, oh, they did histology and they had like Congo red positive staining with the, I don't know, like apocrine birefringence in the pancreas, you really want to think about type 2 diabetes. The thing is that amyloid that you're finding in the pancreas is actually coming from the amylin. Okay, so just an unrelated point to sort of keep at the back of your mind. Now, if you're going away from pramlintide, right, you want to give like type 1 diabetes legit insulin. It is like, again, floridly high yield to know the different types of insulin and their duration of action. In fact, there are four types of insulin. There's insulins that are ultra rapid acting. There's insulins that are rapid acting. There's insulins that are intermediate acting. And there's insulins that are long acting. Okay. The ultra rapid acting insulins, there's like Lispro. Okay. There is another one known as Aspart. And there's another one known as Glulysine. Okay. So Lispro, Aspart, and Glulysine. And then the rapid acting insulin is just regular insulin. It's literally called insulin regular. And then the intermediate acting insulin, there's only one you need to know. It's known as NPH. I think it's like neutral protamine hagedorn or something ridiculous. Just remember NPH and you're probably good to go. And then the long acting, there's three you need to remember, right? So there's glargine, okay? There is Detemir, so Detemir. And then there is another one known as Degludec, Degludec, okay? The classic thing they may do on an exam is to like show you a graph with insulin and then show you like the peak onset of action after it's given and like the duration of effect. You need to memorize that graph. Just look up a picture of that in your first aid. It's a pretty classic graph, but it shows up all the time on exams. You definitely need to know that graph. Okay, so maybe pause this podcast and go look at that graph just for reinforcement. Okay. And then let's talk about type 2 diabetes. I know this podcast has gone on for almost an hour now. I honestly don't expect it to go this long. So let's talk again. I'll just talk about metformin and then that'll be it. In fact, you know what? I'll just talk about metformin because it's kind of tricky. So metformin. Metformin is a big one-eyed, right? The drug class is a big one-eyed class. No one really knows how metformin works. But if you're thinking about your biochemistry, you could potentially propose a mechanism for how metformin works. So let's talk about this for a second, because this has a very nice biochem tie-in, right? So the classic boss phrase you'll see in many pharmacology texts in your first aid, whatever, is that metformin decreases hepatic gluconeogenesis. Well, how might that be the case? The thing is, in my biochem reviews, I talked about a cycle known as the Cori cycle. Okay, I talked about the Cori cycle. The thing is, the Cori cycle takes place in the liver. And what does the Cori cycle do? Basically, the Cori cycle takes like lactate from like muscle, from red cells, and converts that to pyruvate, and then converts that converts the lactate back to pyruvate. Obviously, that'll be under the activity of a lactate dehydrogenase. And then in the process of gluconeogenesis, you convert that pyruvate back to glucose. Okay. Well, the thing is, if you're an organ that does the Cori cycle, by default, you need to be an organ that can do gluconeogenesis. And it so happens that the two organs that can do that are your kidneys and your liver, right? Your liver is probably like the bigger guy in that situation. So we said that metformin decreases hepatic gluconeogenesis. So let's say you're basically cutting off the gluconeogenesis that happens in the liver. Literally, that's what metformin does. The thing is, if you're cutting down on hepatic gluconeogenesis, that gluconeogenic phase of the Cori cycle will not work. Okay? If that gluconeogenic phase of the Cori cycle does not work, then everything that is upstream of that in the Cori cycle will build up. So your pyruvate will begin to build up. And if your pyruvate builds up, guess what will build up as well? Your lactate. Your lactic acid will build up. So this is the potential mechanism behind metformin causing a lactic acidosis, a life-threatening lactic acidosis. Okay, so metformin can cause a high anion gap metabolic acidosis, basically again a lactic acidosis. So this is why, in general, a person has renal insufficiency, if a person's kidneys are not working right, you probably do not want to give them metformin. Another classic way they test this concept on exams is they can talk about someone with like a history of diabetes, like type 2 diabetes, as getting an imaging study, right? Let's assume like they have a pee or whatever, right? And you want to do like some kind of CAT scan that involves a CT scan that involves a contrast. Remember that contrast can cause intrarenal AKI. Okay, so for those people, you need to hold that metformin. In fact, if a person is getting a potentially nephrotoxic agent, you need to hold metformin. In fact, I'll tell you this as a clinical pearl for the future. Always do medication reconciliation on your patients, right? If a patient is coming to the hospital and they're on metformin, just stop the metformin and place them on insulin, okay? If a patient is coming into the hospital, that's something that I pretty much always do. Stop their metformin and just place them on insulin, regardless. It doesn't matter. Just stop their metformin. Trust me, you don't want to deal with the lactic acidosis that can arise with metformin. It can be life-threatening in some people. And then the next thing I'll say about metformin, right? So you hear that it decreases hepatic gluconeogenesis. So I've talked about how you can link that to lactic acidosis as a side effect of metformin. But another thing people say, at least again, if you read your first aid, you read your pharmacology text, is that metformin increases insulin sensitivity. What's the potential mechanism behind that? The potential mechanism is that metformin actually increases the activity of an enzyme known as AMP kinase. So like AMPK, AMP kinase, right? So how does this increase insulin sensitivity? Well, let's talk about the mechanism. The thing is, remember your glucose transporters, right? We have GLUT4. Of those glucose transporters, one of the important ones are the GLUT4 transporters, right? Remember, we'll find them on adipocytes and on the surface of a skeletal muscle cells. It's an insulin-dependent glucose transporter. The thing is, insulin actually helps you put more GLUT4 on the surface of your skeletal myocytes. But the thing is, think about it. If you're exercising, your skeletal muscle needs a ton of glucose, right? So that you can exercise well, right? So the thing is, when you're exercising, guess what? You actually put a ton of GLUT4 transporters on the surface of your skeletal myocytes. But I know you may already be asking a question in your mind, but Divine, wait, if you exercise, you're using up glucose, so your blood glucose levels go down. So if your blood glucose levels are going down, your insulin should not be up. Your insulin will actually be down. So if your insulin is down, how is this GLUT4 transporter getting to the surface of a skeletal myocyte? That's an important question. The thing is, during exercise, your skeletal muscle actually inserts more GLUT4 transporters on its surface in an insulin independent fashion. Okay? And the thing that makes that happen is AMP kinase. Okay? AMP kinase. And you may even wonder, like, Divine, why is this thing called AMP kinase? Think about it again. If you're exercising, you're using up ATP at a very high clip, right? As you're using up that ATP, right? Guess what you'll be making a ton of? AMP. AMP activates that kinase. That's why it's called an AMP kinase. Okay? So, if metformin is helping you activate AMP kinase, by activating AMP kinase, you're putting more GLUT4 on the surface of your skeletal myocytes. If you're putting more GLUT4 receptors on the surface of your skeletal myocytes, you're bringing in more glucose. Okay? But you're doing that without insulin. So, let's say before, you needed, it's like you're basically taking over the functions of insulin in a non-insulin dependent fashion. Okay, so this is the mechanism behind metformin improving insulin sensitivity. It's just one of those things that you may not see on your exam, but I can almost foresee them making this a question that is cell biology or biochemistry related, and this will likely throw many people off. Okay, so it's just one of those things. That's why I'm taking the time to sort of buckle down and explain this. So, to round up this podcast, the big side effects of metformin: lactic acidosis, especially in patients with renal failure, and GI upset. Okay, metformin can cause a GI upset. So I think I'm going to stop here. I know this was long, and before I round off, don't forget I offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE exams, Step 1, Step 2, CK and CS, and Step 3, and also the medicine in training exam and the medicine board exams. And then I also do application prep for med school, so that's the AMCAS application, and residency, that's the ERAS application. I have a lot of experience doing these things, preparing people for interviews and whatnot. So please feel free to send anyone my way that requires any of these services. I do it on a one-on-one basis. So I wish you all the best. I hope the Lakers win their game against whatever team they're playing today. I believe it's the Utah Jazz. So I'll see you guys in the next podcast. Have a wonderful day and God bless. Thank you.